This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tomorrow at the Homestead Miami Speedway, 43 drivers will attempt to go fast and turn left better than their competitors to win the Ford 400, the last race of NASCAR's 2006 season. NASCAR's 2006 championship is also at stake, though the winner of the chase for the Cup could very likely be Jimmy Johnson, who increased his lead on the field to 63 points with a second-place finish in Phoenix last weekend. Matt Crossman of the Sporting News is on the line from Florida to help us sort this all out. Matt, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Bill. It's a pleasure.
Johnson has a 63-point lead, so is it time for Matt Kenseth, Kenneth Harvick, and Denny Hamlin to save gas and stay home?
No, I mean, anything can happen. Last year he was tooling around, doing fine in perfect position. Next thing you know, his tire pops and he hits the wall and he finishes 40th. You know, and racers have a say in that's racing. So definitely, I mean, he's got to finish 12th or better to win, but anything can happen.
It's pretty profound, that's racing.
Yeah, it's one of their great cliches that, you know, it's, you know, the smallest little part that costs a quarter breaks and your car blows up, or it doesn't break and you win the race and you have no control over it.
I hate to do this because I hear that you're only slightly more successful than a sombrero at picking winners, but who comes out on top in Miami on Sunday?
Well, yeah, the sombrero is almost as smart as me. At the start of the season at the Sporting News, I consult a lot of experts to get their picks, and I make my own too. And this year I thought it would be funny to put all the drivers' names in a hat and pick 10 out to see who would qualify for the chase. Well, the sombrero got 3 of them right, and I only got 4. So I'm only, you know, one pick better than a hat.
But
so
better, not, better. You could have been one pick worse, man.
I could have been, and looking at my picks, I'm lucky that I wasn't.
All right, enough of this talk of chapeaux. Who wins on Sunday?
I think you got to go with Jimmy Johnson. The last 5 races, he's finished 2nd 4 times, and the 5th race, he won.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty good. You're not going to beat a guy doing that. And Matt Kenseth himself has been, you know, all doom and gloom and pretty down on both himself and his team. I mean, his car has just been, I mean, he's still going 180 miles an hour, but everyone else is going 182, so that makes his car junk. So I think you got to go with Jimmy.
Ironically, the driver who's been having the most success and the most fun during the chase for the Cup isn't even in the running. How is it that Tony Stewart missed the chase cutoff but still managed to win 3 of the season's last 10 races?
Well, to understand that, you have to understand that the main thing driving Tony Stewart is pride. He basically somehow, even though he's the most successful driver of this generation, he thinks, people think, he's not a very good driver. And so missing the chase, that motivates him to go out there and prove to those who think that he can't, that he can.
You're suggesting that paranoia is an excellent tool for a race car driver.
I'm not suggesting it, I'm saying it. They all, you know, they look like they have massive egos, because they drive around 190 miles an hour and they wear sunglasses and they're just the too cool for school. But inside, they've all got massive inferiority complexes because there's 1,000 guys who want the seat that they have. So they are bent on not letting anyone get it.
I've been saving this headline since late October, Matt, just so I could talk to you about it. This is from ESPN. In great big letters, it says, Jeff Green's Jackman sidelined with torn ACL. Now, I've read a lot of injury reports for football, basketball, baseball, even soccer, but since when does the fate of a NASCAR team depend on the anterior cruciate ligament of a guy who's holding a tire jack?
Well, have you seen how the Jackman runs around the car? He's got basically 2 or 3 seconds to jump over a wall, carrying about a 40-pound jack, run around the front of the car, around another guy, stick the jack under there, crank it 3 times, wait for the guys to get the tire off, pull it out, run back around. They've got to change 4 tires in 11 seconds in order to be successful. If that guy's knee blows, they're done. It's a lot harder than it looks.
Well, Mr. Green's Jackman isn't the only casualty of this NASCAR season. Television ratings are down. In fact, 16 races saw a decline of 10% or more, and less than half of this year's races have been sellouts. What's going on?
I think there's a number of factors. First of all, you can only grow for so long before you level out, and NASCAR has been trumpeting itself ad nauseum. You know, second fastest growing sport in the country, and at some point, you grow so much that you can't maintain that. And the not sells, a lot of it that has to do, frankly, races are better to watch on TV than they are in person because it takes 8 years to get there. It takes 8 years to get home. It's 1,000 degrees. And let's say you're at Daytona. You can be in the stadium and literally be a mile away from the action. I mean, my opinion has always been I'd rather watch the race on TV than be at it. I'm always stunned that the attendance is as high as it is.
Yeah, but what you're describing has been the case for a good long time. Drop-off now? There always seem to be plenty of people who like to camp out and drink their beer and enjoy the race even if they were a mile away.
You know, I'm not really sure I have a real definitive answer for why attendance would be down. You know, the competition is no worse. In fact, it's probably better. You know, it's probably just a cyclical thing. I mean, the economy isn't great. Tickets are at least $80 a pop. Nobody goes to a race alone, so then it's $160 plus parking and all the food and all the beer you can drink. You know, if you stay at home, you save all the money except the beer.
Well, Dale Earnhardt Jr. has weighed in on this matter. He says that NASCAR should shorten its 400 and 500-mile contests. His contention is that the middle of races often become pointless. Does he have a point?
Oh, boy, I love that he said that. I've been beating this drum for a couple of years now. I would make, except for the Daytona 500, which is too iconic to mess with, I would make every race at least 10% shorter. And if I could get others to go along with me, I'd probably go 25% shorter. They take 3.5 hours. It's interminable.
Matt Crossman covers NASCAR for the Sporting News. Matt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
As always, thanks for having me.
By reaching out in recent years beyond its primarily white fan base, NASCAR has begun to change the public face of stock car racing. And now NASCAR is undergoing a diversity initiative aimed not only at bringing more minorities to the stands, but also into its garages, pits, and boardrooms. Only a Game's Rachel McCarthy reports.
If you head south on Route 57 in Rougemont, North Carolina, past the go-kart track on the right, you'll find the Orange County Speedway, home of NASCAR's most loyal fans. At least that's what the sign outside the racetrack says. And with the stands full on a recent Saturday, who's to say they're not?
Although I know that I'm a sinner, help me to believe that with God, I'll always be a winner.
As the minister finishes the opening prayer, fans raise their heads, awaiting the familiar roar of the engines.
Driver, start them up!
Kind of exciting to see the cars, you know, and it's kind of bad to say, but when they hit the walls and stuff, it's kind of exciting too. As long as they don't get hurt, I guess.
Avery Jones works at the track's concession stand and is sneaking a peek at the race during his break. It's no surprise that Jones is one of only a few African Americans here. After all, stock car racing is known for its white Southern roots and its Confederate flag waving fans. But Jones thinks things have been changing.
I see more and more minorities coming in. I guess anybody could be interested if they come and watch it every now and then.
That's what NASCAR has been banking on.
Any sport wants to grow its fan base.
NASCAR spokesperson Ramsey Poston.
The more that you can broaden your sport, the more you can make your sport look like the rest of America, the more competitive it is and the more popular it is.
Earl Smith is a sociology professor and the director of the American Ethnic Studies Program at Wake Forest University.
Advertising, major primetime advertising. NASCAR put the time, energy, and money into getting people to notice who they are. The point is, the exposure has brought in more people, and the net has been cast wider, and so therefore you're going to catch African Americans.
Those efforts have been paying off. According to a 2005 ESPN sports poll, African Americans now account for almost 10% of NASCAR fans, a significant jump from just a few years ago. But NASCAR says that's still not enough. The organization's been working on a multifaceted plan, aiming to attract more African Americans, as well as Latinos, Asians, and women, to more accurately reflect America's varied population. NASCAR's Drive for Diversity program identifies and develops young minority drivers. But with only one African American currently competing in NASCAR's Elite Series, and no minority drivers reaching household name status, the Tiger Woods effect clearly hasn't kicked in. Again, Professor Earl Smith.
It's in their best interest to be involved with the minority community. And one of the ways they can do that that's much more sound, drivers come and go. And if you don't have a legacy, I mean, you look at some of the drivers here in the South, they've got fathers, they got their kids, then they have their kids. It's a family tradition. If you don't have that with these new African-American drivers, then it stands to reason. One of the ways you can do this is by bringing in people at the so-called mid-management space in this sort of corporate business.
Earlier this year, NASCAR announced its plan to help develop motorsports degree programs at historically black colleges and universities to draw more African Americans into the industry. Dr. Travis Teague is the coordinator of the new Motorsports Management Program at Winston-Salem State University in North Carolina, which will introduce courses this fall in risk management, marketing, sponsorship development, logistics, event planning, and operations at the racetrack.
These places turn into almost cities themselves, 160, 170 or more thousand folks that are on site, and they have to be managed. So as the fan base grows, so do the need for positions within all aspects of racing, and what we're doing is meeting a need.
And Wake Forest professor Earl Smith sees NASCAR's involvement as more than just a window dressing.
By partnering with some of these historically black colleges and universities, they're saying that they're in it for the long haul. They're saying they want to train people to get into this business as opposed to showcase people. That looks plausible, and it looks real.
But wholesale changes like that might not be to everyone's liking. Jason Dukes is an African-American NASCAR fan, former NASCAR employee, and is currently business development manager at Gateway International Raceway. He sees the potential for some resistance.
If you go back 5-10 years ago, it was kind of hardline what NASCAR meant and what it stood for. The meaning has changed. I don't think it's no longer, you know, older white male North Carolina pickup truck. It's changing its meaning to be more inclusive, really to be more corporate, to kind of sacrificing what you stand for.
For some, stock car racing might stand for racial intolerance. Reports of fans and competitors hurling racial epithets at African-American drivers at tracks in the South this season prompted denunciation from NASCAR. And the opinions of a few aren't deterring NASCAR from putting the pedal to the metal when it comes to diversity. NASCAR spokesperson Ramsey Poston.
We like to say we're now in the 21st century and we're not going to be stuck in the 20th century. And we're going to move forward, and whether it's drivers behind the wheel, whether it's crewmen behind the wall, or executives in the front office.
For Only a Game, I'm Rachel McCarthy in Rougemont, North Carolina.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, will the Terps two-peat or will they turn turtle? But first, he lectured on Shakespeare at Yale. He and George Bernard Shaw corresponded for years, took long walks together, and mentored each other. When he married socialite Polly Lauder, she was attended by a Rockefeller, and Thornton Wilder was a guest. And, oh yeah, he was heavyweight champion of the world. No wonder Gene Tunney fascinated Jack Kavanaugh, who has written a biography of the man who beat Jack Dempsey to assume the heavyweight title in 1926. Jack Kavanaugh joins me now from WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Mr. Kavanaugh, welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be aboard, Bill.
Years before they finally met in a fight for the heavyweight championship, Gene Tunney was convinced that he could take the title from Jack Dempsey. This is even though Tunney had lost to somebody named Harry Greb, a light heavyweight, a good fighter but hardly an immortal, and 17 of Tunney's early fights had ended in no decisions. Why was Tunney so sure that he could beat Dempsey?
What happened in 1921, in the first million-dollar gate fight in Jersey City, Tunney was on the undercard, you know, preliminary fight. Mm-hmm. He was on the way up, but pretty much ignored by the New York sports writers. And Dempsey fought Georges Carpentier, the great French fighter who was the light heavyweight champion. And in the preliminary, Tunney fought a guy named Soldier Jones, beat him. Wasn't too impressive. When the fight was over, Tunney put a robe on and decided not to go into the locker room. He went over in the corner of the ring. He wanted to watch Dempsey up close, first time he'd ever seen him. He saw something early on. He saw that Dempsey was very vulnerable to right hand. Tunney thought, do I see something? And he saw Dempsey subsequently several more times at ringside and said, the first thing I do when I get in a ring with him, he thinks I'm going to run because, you know, I'm lighter than him, but I'm going to stop right in my tracks in mid-ring, and I'm going to hit him with that right. As soon as he cocks to the left, boom, I'm going to hit him with the right. That's exactly what happened. When that happened in the first Dempsey-Tunney fight. Tunney knew right then in the first round, I've got him beat. And Dempsey was to say later on, hey, they say this guy can't hit. He hurt me. when he hurt me in that first round, I knew I was in trouble. Indeed, he was. Tunney won all 10 rounds of the fight, all 10 rounds. And here he was like 4-1 underdog.
Dempsey was reviled by people, including sports writers, who felt that he'd avoided military service during the First World War. He was called a slacker. Tunney served in the Marines, and yet Dempsey was the crowd favorite when the two met in the ring. Why?
Well, first of all, the draft deferment that Dempsey got, he regretted till the day he died, but he was entitled to it. He had a family of a father who rarely worked. His mother was frail, and he had about seven or eight siblings who still survived, and he was married. He married at the age of 19. He married a 34-year-old prostitute. To say the least, this was not exactly a marriage made in heaven, and it didn't last very long. But in the first fight, the crowd favorite in Philadelphia was Tunney. Here you got this handsome, literate former Marine fighting against the slacker, you know, who never went to war. Mm-hmm. Yet, when the fight ended, and after Tunney won all 10 rounds, as Dempsey left the ring, and the crowd began to cheer him as he was walking down the aisle, he couldn't believe his ears. And the great quote by Dempsey was, "Losing was the making of me." His wife, second wife, movie actress Estelle Taylor, her pet nickname for him was Ginsburg, because Dempsey, a lot of people know this, was part Jewish. Mm-hmm. She says, "What in the heck happened, Ginsburg?" He says, "Honey, I forgot to duck." It became, and that quote endeared him all the more to people around the country. And Tunney now becomes unpopular, and he becomes kind of standoffish, the literary bent thing. Him at training camp, he's over in the hammock, you know, reading The Way of All Flesh by Samuel Butler or Shakespeare. And I mean, what is this guy? You know, Damon Runyon, Ring Lardner, Grantland Rice, they all made fun of him. They felt, hey, this guy's not supposed to be reading Shakespeare. You should be hanging out with your spar mates, you know, and like Dempsey, roughhousing with him, playing pinochle. And here he'd come to a press conference after a sparring session, and he'd have a Somerset Maugham's of Human Bondage, you know. He'd put it right down on the table, and they'd see it. And he was so determined to be self-educated, high school dropout at 15. He began to use long words. He'd read the dictionary. That just kind of made them all the more not so much unhappy, but disrespectful of Tunney. They thought he really was a literary poser.
In their first fight, Gene Tunney became the first heavyweight champion to assume the title without knocking out the champion. He beat him in every round. He outboxed Dempsey, but he didn't knock him out. And then, according to your account, the rematch provided the most controversial circumstance ever to occur in a heavyweight championship fight. Tell us about that.
It was the most famous fight of all time, even more so than Ali Frazier won because of the long count fight. Tunney wins the first six rounds easy. He's coasting again. He's now won 16 rounds in a row against the man killer, the Manasseh Mauler. In the seventh round, all of a sudden, Dempsey connects with a right, followed by a tremendous left hook, which knocks Tunney into the ropes, then a barrage of punches, about five or six punches. He goes down. They had just about a year before, in most states, including New York, had put a new rule in effect. It was the neutral corner rule. You knock an opponent down, you had to go to the furthest neutral corner. Before that, a fighter would stand right over another fighter, as Dempsey would do and used to doing. Dempsey, in the heat of the battle, forgot about that new rule. So he stood right over Tunney, and the famous picture of him standing over Tunney down, one arm on the ropes. The referee, Dave Barry, is telling him to go to the corner. Meanwhile, the timekeeper, counting at the bell, is counting one, two, three, you know. Finally, Dempsey realized, hey, I got to get to the corner. And then Dave Barry, turns to Tunney, ignores the timekeeper's count, and starts one, two, three. Well, he was reviled for that, but that was the rule. So Tunney could have been down anywhere from 14 to 18 seconds, probably closer to 17. Tunney always insisted when he heard the referee say two, which would have been maybe seven or eight, and he finally got up at nine. He was smart enough to take the full nine, and he knew he was down there for quite a while. But he always insisted. He insisted he could have got up before, even if the referee had counted, you know, started counting right away.
After Gene Tunney defended his title against Dempsey, he beat Tom Heaney in 1928 by a technical knockout, and then he retired. He was still a young guy. Why hang him up when he did?
Well, what happened before the first Dempsey fight, he met Polly Lauder, this beautiful heiress to the Carnegie fortune, a beautiful woman, and he fell in love with her. So now he fights Dempsey. He beats Dempsey the first time. She wants him to, you know, retire. He says, no, I got to fight him again one more time because I can make a lot of money. His guarantee was $700,000, but the crowd at Soldier Field was 145,000. Incredible. The biggest crowd ever to see a sports event. It topped the Philadelphia crowd. There's never been an event in this country that has had a bigger crowd. And so with all that crowd, he got, part of the proceeds, the size of the crowd, he wound up with $992,000. Astronomical. Nobody ever made that much in the fight. So Tex Rickard, the promoter, gives him the check, and he says, I don't want it. Rickard says, what? You don't want it? Tony says, you know what I want you to do? Write me out a check for $1 million. I want to be the first athlete, first entertainer in history to make $1 million in one night. And I'll give you a check for $8,000. You give me one for $1 million. Hung it up in his garage in North Stamford. I think it may still be there, the canceled check. And he was indeed the first, not only first athlete, first probably person ever to make $1 million in one night.
There's a wonderful story toward the end of the book in which years after Gene Tunney had retired, one of his acquaintances approaches him and refers to him as Champ. And Tunney quietly pulls him aside and says, don't call me that. Why not?
Once he distanced himself from boxing, as he told me, and he said, you know, they're always asking me to go to big fights. They're going to pay my expenses to go over and see Ingemar Johansson and Floyd Patterson fight in Stockholm at the time I met him. And he said, my wife, everything's first class. I don't want to go. That was that. I'm now a CEO of a company. He was CEO of two companies on 12 boards of directors. He said, that was a part of my life that's long ago. I don't really want to go and do that. I don't want to go to the fights. Let the fighters themselves get the glory. Meanwhile, Dempsey, the guy he beat twice, running one of the most popular restaurants in New York in Times Square, everybody called him Champ, and he loved it. Old fighters love to be called Champ, you know? So the guy I mentioned, who was a friend of mine from Stanford, Don Russell, who was a broadcaster at NBC at that time, was riding the train with Tunney. And Tunney would ride the train, like I said, anyway, the commuter, you know, read the paper in the morning. And Russell called him Champ, and I guess a little loud, you know. And they got off the train in Grand Central, they're walking across the concourse, and Tunney turns to Russell, Don Russell. He says, Don, please do me a favor. Don't ever call me Champ, he says. It draws attention to me.
Jack Cavanaugh is the author of Tunney, Boxing's Brainiest Champ, and his upset of the great Jack Dempsey, published by Random House. He joined me from the studios of WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Jack, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Say you're a Roethlisberger fan, and most people will assume you root for the Pittsburgh Steelers, since that's the team Ben Roethlisberger quarterbacks. But if all goes according to plan, there will soon be lots of Roethlisberger fans in Norman, Oklahoma, where Ben's sister will be playing her college basketball. Joining me now to discuss the family connections of various female hoopsters, as well as which women's teams could meet in the Final Four many months hence, is Michelle Smith, who writes about the women's game for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, lovely to be here.
The University of Oklahoma women's team now has four players with impressive sports pedigrees. Besides the aforementioned Carly Roethlisberger, the Sooners have former pro football lineman Bubba Parris's twin daughters, one of whom holds the NCAA record for rebounds. And they have Abi Olajuwon, Hakeem Olajuwon's daughter.
Yes.
No surprise, I guess, that they're ranked in the top five this season.
They're a very good team, but it all begins and ends for Oklahoma with Courtney Parris. Her sister Ashley is a very good player, but Courtney is an extraordinary player, perhaps one of those once or twice in a generation kind of players. She's big, she's talented, she's, you know, for her, she does everything that, you know, a girl of her size you would hope she'd be able to do. She's got great hands, great sense, you know, and she's a really an interesting kid, very funny, can, you know, hold her own in a room full of reporters, and apparently is quite a good recruiter, too, because she's had a big hand in some of the recruiting coups that Oklahoma's had in the last year or two.
The number one ranked team is Maryland. They won the championship last year. All five starters are returning, as are three other players. Do they win again?
Very possibly. You know, it's hard to repeat, and everybody will be, you know, I mean, everybody, the cliche is everybody's gunning for you after that, but it is actually true. You will get everybody's best game. It will mean everybody's season to be able to knock you off, whether it's, you know, in November or in March. So the challenge is pretty significant. And then in addition to having all of their players back, they have a transfer from Tennessee, Shade Wiley-Gatewood, who was a, you know, very talented guard, has been fighting through some injury issues a little bit, but they're loaded.
It's interesting that you mention that transfer, Michelle. Pat Summitt's Tennessee team did not make the Final Four last season. She's been saying the Vols should be better this year, but three of her players transferred to other schools. What leads a basketball player to leave Tennessee?
I think that it's the same thing that leads a basketball player to leave Duke or to leave any other program, because that's happened a couple of times to the Blue Devils. I think that particularly with women, I probably am going to get in trouble for generalizing, but I think they want to feel like it's about more than the basketball. It's about the experience for them. It's about the bonding. It's about the fit. And I think if it is not a fit, I think it's just easier or it feels better to go find something that fits better.
One player who has remained at Tennessee is Candace Parker. Coach
Yes.
Summitt says that she should become the best player women's basketball has ever seen. Is she nuts putting that kind of pressure on her star?
That's not an unfamiliar position for Pat, who had Shamequa Holdsclaw, who had that billing as well, and Tamika Catchings, who's, you know, Pat's had these players run through her program who seem, again, like Courtney Paris, to be generational talents. And, you know, I think that Candace is a mature kid, and she's pretty confident enough that I think she can wear that and not feel too much pressure from it.
Candace Parker, of course, played with a collection of WNBA players on Team USA in September. I wonder if she's going to feel a letdown returning to the college game.
You know, no, she won't. I mean, that's certainly playing at a very high level. The international game is a little bit different, but I think that going for a national championship with your college team is an experience that many of these women just have said once they get to the WNBA, it's not the same. You can't duplicate it. There's just something sort of very special about that experience that I think Candace Parker appreciates. And, you know, if she was only in it for the basketball, maybe the level of competition isn't going to be as high. But I think that journey is a big appeal.
Michelle, we're in a curious position of asking you to sort of preview the women's season, even though the women's season has already begun, and it's begun with some surprises.
Yes, absolutely it has. You know, I know out here our team, Stanford, got knocked off in the second round of the WNIT by BYU, which was a big surprise. Stanford was ranked number 4 in the country. I think this is going to be another season building toward parity. I saw a quote from Pat Summitt said, parity is great for everybody, but I don't like it that much. Because, you know, it seems to be that the playing field is leveling. I mean, the best conference in the country, again, probably this year, is not going to be the SEC or even the Big 12, which carried the mantle for a few years, but the ACC. The Pac-10 has 6 teams ranked to start the preseason rankings in a conference that hasn't gotten a ton of respect, in large part because a lot of people don't see them play, but there's some good teams. It's going to be a pretty wide-open season.
Better and better times for high school basketball players who are female.
Yes. I mean, and the talent level that's coming out of high school is, you know, I mean, it really just is getting better every year. And the coaches say that, and the recruits, and, you know, the recruiting process. I mean, the level of the athletes that they're looking at, these high school kids are, you know, the same level as the players that they were coaching as juniors and seniors 5 and 6 years ago. They just really believe that the game is elevating so much.
All right, enough with the preliminaries. Which teams are we going to see in the Final Four this spring?
I think Maryland is almost a lock. They're just, you know, anything happens in the tournament, but a team with that much talent seems to be destined to be back. North Carolina with Ivory Lauda and Camille Little, very strong team. I mean, and then you've got, kind of Oklahoma, you've got Tennessee, you've got Connecticut maybe making a resurgence this season. You know, you've got the team out here out west, Stanford, who took it on the chin the other night, but it's mid-November, as they keep telling themselves, and they've got some talent out here. I mean, I think that there's maybe 10 teams who can end up in that final group of 4 pretty legitimately, and maybe you could even say a dozen.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a day at the races unlike any previous day at the races. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Yesterday afternoon, a man as thoroughly identified as anyone could be with the football rivalry between Michigan and Ohio State passed away. How should former Michigan coach Bo Schembechler be remembered?
Well, he's one of the last really iconic figures that stayed his entire career with one program, became identified with one program.
Mm-hmm.
You think about Bear Bryant, Woody Hayes, and Darryl Royal at Texas, and to an extent Frank Broyles at Arkansas and people like that. Bo Schembechler was really the last of them.
Ohio State coach Jim Tressel has already said Bo Schembechler, quote, will always be both a Buckeye and a Wolverine, a designation with which Mr. Schembechler would have been comfortable?
Well, he was a, he was an assistant at Ohio State under Woody Hayes, who we talk about when we're talking about iconic figures,
mm-hmm.
before going to Michigan in 1969. But it's hard to believe that in 1969, when he took over the Michigan team, they had six losing seasons in the previous 11 years. It's hard to imagine, given the corporate juggernaut that University of Michigan sports has turned into, that would ever be possible.
There's a good deal at stake in tomorrow's game between Ohio State and Michigan. Is it fair to say that this is something of a dream matchup at this point in the season?
Yeah, this is as good as college football can get, even though it's going to pony up some sort of phony national championship game at the end, possibly between these same two teams. But this has, this is the color and pageantry. It's on one of the campuses. The campuses are not that far from each other. And now, of course, the emotional pitch has been raised to something probably only dogs and Wolverines can hear.
Elsewhere in football, your guy Tom Brady has a new backup, assuming Vinny Testaverde refrains from competing for the starting quarterback job. Are you anticipating having to write a book about Vinny Testaverde?
Well, I don't know exactly, because I'm not really good at chiseling stories on stone tablets. And folks are unclear as to whether Vinny had to wait to sign to see how the carbon 14 testing turned out. But seriously, folks, it's great to be back here in Foxborough.
The University of North Texas needs to rename its new athletic facility. As we all know, the highest bidder usually has that honor bestowed upon him or her. But the Mean Green apparently may lose the Mean Green. Why?
Well, because Jim McIngvale, known locally around town as Mattress Mac, because he does these strange commercials for his furniture empire, making him sort of a real-life Nathan Arizona, has said he wanted the practice facility to get renamed for a coach named Daryl Dickey, who had a heart attack and then was fired. He doesn't believe that firing a guy 3 weeks after he had a heart attack was the right thing to do. As McIngvale points out, even Wall Street's not that callous. He's given them an ultimatum. They rename the facility after Daryl Dickey, who was just fired, or the $1 million goes to the music department. Which way are you rooting, Bill?
I got my fingers crossed that the trombone section gets the money. Even though the U.S. team didn't win the first World Baseball Classic, there will apparently be a second World Baseball Classic. I think it would be fair to stage the 2009 edition of the Classic in Japan.
I think you should win the right to host the next one. I think that's a very good idea. And I think that by the time they do have the World Baseball Classic, if they do have it in Japan, there'll be an unusual number of people in the stands wearing Boston Red Sox caps.
Yes, because speaking of baseball in Japan, is Daisuke Matsuzaka really so good that the Red Sox should have paid $51 million for the opportunity to talk to him?
Boy, he better be, because this is the Fisher cut bait moment for Theo Epstein. If this one doesn't work out, he's fired. Because pretty plainly, they had to tie Larry Lucchino to a chair with duct tape in the basement of Fenway Park to get this thing done. I mean, it's already been intriguing. At the Boston Globe, we've already had one Japanese television film crew go floating through the newsroom to do interviews about the arrival of my man Dice.
Which is not a sure thing yet.
No, they've still got to sign him on top of everything else. But everyone is rooting for that perfect storm of Japanese media in the first game in Fort Myers, when the Yankees and the Red Sox play, and you have the Matsui media and the Matsuzaka media colliding behind the batting cage. And, oh, by the way, real estate prices in Fort Myers just went through the roof.
It's no surprise that Jim Leland was the American League's manager of the year, Charlie. He took the Tigers much further than most people thought they would go. But do you suppose the Florida Marlins front office was at least a little bit embarrassed when Joe Girardi was named National League Manager of the Year?
Yeah, I mean, anything that embarrasses Jeffrey Loria, the owner of the Florida team, in public is fine by me. Joe Girardi did a terrific job. He couldn't get along with the dunce who owned the team. That's a firing offense. Everybody in professional sports knows it. But I think having the Manager of the Year award to perhaps drive around Loria's, you know, magnificent, you know, compound in Florida, leaning on your horn and saying, "See, dummy, look what I got," is fine by me.
This week, in a 25-page letter to the U.S. Congress, NCAA President Miles Brand defended that organization's tax-exempt status by arguing that the NCAA's priority is to educate athletes. Does Brand's reasoning hold any water, or perhaps more appropriately, any Gatorade?
Excuse me. Miles Brand, capable of saying almost anything to Congress. This is my favorite, though. The lessons learned on the football field or the men's basketball court are no less in value or importance to those student-athletes than the ones learned on the hockey rink or the softball diamond, nor, for that matter, than those learned in theater, dance, music, journalism, or other non-classroom environments. I think we now refer to the Final Four every year as the very large NCAA non-classroom environment. And by the way, if he wants to know about what happens in music class, let him talk to Mattress Mac McInvale down there in Texas. Well, he knows. He ain't running no damn daisy farm down there.
I'd also bring up the point that journalism is something one can actually major in. Charlie, hackers have apparently stolen data from the lab in France that handled Floyd Landis's Tour de France tests. Landis may lose his claim on the Tour de France title as a result of those tests. Will the hacking have any impact on Mr. Landis's status?
Well, I don't know about hacking having any impact on his status. It's already had an impact on the various conspiracy theories floating around this very strange series of events. The people who are convinced that Floyd Landis did enhance his performance are now claiming that it was Landis's side who hacked into the computer to prove that the lab was insecure. Nobody's really sure about anything. It's fairly clear the lab was insecure because somebody got the data.
And finally, Charlie, when I was a little leaguer, teams were sponsored by insurance agencies, restaurants, the local five and dime, places like that. At least in England, I guess things may be changing for those involved in youth sports.
Motorhead rules! They're sponsoring their own team. They're going to have the Snaggletooth, the famous band logo on the shirts. They're going to have they run out the field on the song Ace of Spades, which I'm told is one of Motorhead's biggest hits. I think it's terrific. I can hardly wait till the kids get a little older and they can play for Freddie and the Dreamers or Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His most recent book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady Tries to Stay a Step Ahead of Vinny Testaverde, is in the
Very
stores.
Good.
Even as we speak, he joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
You know I'm going to lose, and gambling's for fools, but that's the way I like it, baby. I don't want to live forever.
For 35 years, Calder Racecourse in Miami Gardens has been offering thoroughbred racing, a simple proposition wherein some number of horses run around an oval and some number of people who've bet wisely or luckily on the horses finishing first, second, or third collect money, sometimes no little and quite some, for their efforts. But in recent years, the growth of the casino industry and various other opportunities to lose one's money, some of them sponsored by state governments, have brought hard times to the horse racing industry. Next weekend, Calder Racecourse will try to reclaim some of its patrons with an event folks there are calling Extreme Day. Joining me now to discuss this occasion is Calder Vice President and Marketing Director Michael Cronin. Mr. Cronin, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Normally, the Daily Double offers racetrack patrons who pick the winner of both the first and second races before the first race is run the opportunity for a windfall, but my understanding is that Extreme Day will begin with the world's fastest Daily Double. How's that going to work?
Well, we don't think it's ever been done before. At least we hope not, because we've been advertising it as such. The fastest Daily Double is literally two races run at the same time. One will start, and then within a second or two later, the next one will start. And therefore, we consider that instead of waiting around 20 minutes or a half hour, you'll find out in about a minute and a half if your daily double has come in.
Now, the way you're doing this, of course, is you've got a turf track and a dirt track, right?
Exactly. So we're keeping our fingers crossed because I have to be honest, full disclosure here, we did try this back in August. But being South Florida in August, it monsooned, and we had to take one of the races off the turf, off the grass, and therefore we couldn't do it. So this is take two, and we hope this one actually fulfills its promise.
Is there any danger while this is happening that some or all of the horses get confused about whom they're racing against?
No, but we haven't asked the jockeys. But now, you know what? The horses are going to be on separate tracks,
yeah.
And so we don't really think there'll be much of an issue with that. And if there were at all, we wouldn't be doing it. We've kind of tested this out a little bit in advance, both from a television viewpoint and from the horse racing viewpoint, and all went on without a flaw.
Extreme Day will also feature the $45,000 Gray Pride Stakes. I've got that name right, haven't I?
You do indeed. We thought it'd be a little bit catchy, and especially in this day and age with the AARP being so strong. I can't tell you, people that are novices to the sport, they always tend to want to bet the grays. So this time we're going to make it impossible for them to lose because literally every horse in the race is going to be a gray.
And impossible for them to know which horse to bet, too.
Exactly. So they may put a little bit more in than they get back, but at least they'll have a winning ticket if they bet all the grays.
Would Extreme Day ever have happened if attendance weren't an issue?
I think it would have. I happen to be maybe a little bit of a throwback. I'm pretty much of a purist. I'm not really too excited about slot machines, and I'm not really excited about, in a sense, making the sport other than what it really truly is, which is centered on the horse. These animals, these thoroughbreds are just gorgeous. So I think maybe it pushes you to be a little bit more creative, but you know, my hero in life growing up was Bill Veeck, and Bill Veeck did anything and everything to promote the greatest game there is, which is baseball. And that's kind of how I like to approach racing. Great respect for the game, but the greater respect you have for the game, the more you realize it's about fun and enjoyment. So that's kind of been our catalyst.
Well, you've got one event in Extreme Day that says Bill Veeck in big neon flashing letters, and that, of course, is the one that has the jockeys racing against each other without benefit of horses.
Yes. We're so used to these big, beautiful animals breaking from the gate, and for whatever reason, it just catches everybody by surprise and hits everybody's humor, funny bone, whatever, when you see these usually about 5'1", 5'2", very good athletes, but they're not exactly known for their running ability. They're known for their skills on top of that horse. So it's really been fun, and they, in fairness, too, they are just good sports about it, and they have a lot of fun with it.
Do you think that people who show up for the novelty races will come back to the track on days when the attraction is old-fashioned horse racing?
I can't say the vast majority will, but some will, and it's like any form of sampling in any business. You're never going to hit, you know, 1,000%, but if you can bring some of them back and they enjoy the game, they enjoy the sport more, that's really all you can ask. I think the day where you're going to just all of a sudden revolutionize the sport and they're going to be breaking down the turnstiles just really isn't very practical in this day and age. But if we get a few, that'll be great.
Calder Racecourse staged its first extreme day, or perhaps I should say tried to stage its first extreme day back in the summer, but terrible weather abbreviated the fun. How did people respond to that promotion the first time you tried it?
We had a very good crowd, considering that it literally was, you know, a monsoon. It was just an unbelievably, even for South Florida during the summer, torrential downpour. And we had, I would say, probably about 30 or 40% more people than we normally would have had. Normally, we'd have like between, I would say, 5 or 6,000 people, especially on a bad weather day like that. And we were up around 9 or 10,000. But, you know, they all were waiting for the wrong way race. They were waiting for the fastest daily double. And unfortunately, we couldn't do those. But it seemed to be a certain festive air because we had some novices there. And even the people who had been coming to the track for 20 years, we're kind of like, I can't wait to see what this is going to be. So it was a fun day. Unfortunately, like we said, because of the weather, we weren't able to pull off all the races. But this time, knock on wood, we will.
Assuming that Extreme Day is a success, do you expect that the marketing people and public relations people from tracks around the country will be calling you?
Well, they already have, you know, and like, there's a healthy amount of competition in this sport among tracks, but I can honestly say when we were starting to advertise this and promote it, I got a number of emails and calls from people around the country, and they were all incredibly supportive of it. And to a person, they all said, you know, what's great about this is you're not giving away something, you're not doing a concert, you're dealing with the horses and the racing, and we think it's great. So I'm not sure you can really do this more than once or twice, though, because once you've done it, you know, you've done it.
It would have to be, you know, more and more bizarre and absurd. And I mean, even Bill Veeck didn't have an infinite, resume.
That's true. And the only one that we thought of, which we can't figure out how we're going to do, is have a horse race in water. But we haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Michael Cronin is the Vice President and Marketing Director at Calder Racecourse. He spoke to me from the track in Miami. Michael, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Elias Feldman and from Julie Fredino at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Tunney, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from NASCAR fan and Gateway International Raceway employee Jason Dukes.
For sure. There aren't many African-Americans from New Jersey who work for NASCAR and like are vegetarians and like country music and do yoga and swing dance.
What? You haven't heard of the Hoboken, Hackensack, and Hohokus home for habitués of Harvick, Hummus, Hank Williams, and Hatha Yoga? Remarkable. Fellow must not have been paying attention. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.